Welcome back to our regularly scheduled Torah in Motion programming. I am Ari Lamb, and it's really a pleasure to have spent the day with all of you. I'm always reminded when I give this talk of Jerry Seinfeld's comment that he doesn't understand sports fans because of a peculiar anomaly that attends all sports fandom, which is the following. You can have a player A, Joe Smith. Joe Smith has played for the Toronto Blue Jays for a decade, and he is beloved, and he's well liked. Then he gets traded, and a day later, he's public enemy number one. It makes no sense. So it can't be reasons Jerry Seinfeld that we're rooting for the players that play on our team, because if that were true, then our love for them would follow them for their entire careers, and clearly it does not. So it must be that what we're rooting for is the laundry. We like people who wear our laundry better than people who wear someone else's laundry, and when those people do well, we cheer for their socks. Of course, I think there is actually an element of truth to this, and there may be something deeper at play there, but in a sense, I think it really is getting at something interesting, which is the following. The first time that I gave this talk, I was told by one of my balabatim, with whom I'm extremely close, I was told in no uncertain terms, the original title of this talk was, "Is it mutter to play sports?" And follow sports. I was told in no uncertain terms by my balabas, that depending on the answer to that question, depending on the answer that I gave, we may or may not spend any time together afterwards. So I won't tell you whether or not we're still friends, because I want to leave you hanging. This lecture, as it's titled now, essentially has two components. And to put it in Litvish Lumdus terms, the first question we'll have to ask regards the matir for playing sports, and the second issue that we'll have to explore regards the kiyum in playing sports. What I mean by that is, first we have to establish, is it permissible at all from a halachic perspective? And we'll have to define what that means. Is it permissible at all from a halachic perspective, not just to follow sports, but to play sports at all? Depending on our answer to that question, then we will have to establish, is there, even if it is permissible on a halachic level, on a technical halachic level, is it laudable to play sports? Is it laudable to follow sports? Is there any intrinsic positive moral value, is there positive moral content involved or engaged in playing and following sports? And those two things may be very different. So I'd like to start our analysis on the matir side of things with a series of issues. And just to parenthetically, at the outset, what I'd like to exclude from the conversation, although I acknowledge that it is a crucial component of it, is the question of chavala. Chavala is the prohibition in Jewish law against wounding another person, or in fact wounding yourself. There's a debate amongst the poskim whether or not the prohibition against chavala applies to and among non-Jews. But be that as it may, we're going to leave that issue aside because what I'm interested is not in sort of a technical, practical halachic analysis, but more a question of first halachic principles. From a halachic values perspective, what is at stake in the playing and observing of sports? So, I'll direct your attention on the source sheets that I've given out to the first three sources. The first three sources are from the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, and each one, for those of you who don't have sources, there are source sheets on some of the tables that I've handed out. The Rambam in the Mishneh Torah develops a threefold scheme that superficially seems to be internally contradictory regarding the importance of safeguarding oneself. Now, why is this important? If you'll look at the picture that I provided you on your source sheet, one, not necessarily controversial, although perhaps it should be controversial, but one salient characteristic of athletics is that you run the risk, and of course it's a spectrum, but you run the risk of either mild to extremely serious to life-altering injury. Now, given this, is one allowed to engage in athletics if one runs the risk, and we have to define the risk, but if one runs the risk of harming oneself? So the Rambam has three things to say about this, none of which seems compatible with any of the others. Look in source number one. In Hilchos Deos, the Rambam enumerates for us a series of activities that he prescribes for the purpose of promoting one's health. He says that a person should engage in these activities. Why? Because it's important to promote health. How does the Rambam know this? We'll have to ask that question in a moment. Why? What is the Rambam's source for this? We'll have to ask. Rambam says, V'chol ha-minhagos ha-tovim ha-elu she-amarnu, all of the laudable customs that I have just detailed, ein ray linhog behen ela habari. Only a perfectly healthy, normal person should engage in these activities, exercise and the like. Aval achole, o mi she'echad me'ivarav chole, o mi she'nahag min agra shanim rabos, but a person who is either sick, or one of whose appendages has decayed, or who is otherwise incapacitated, or a person who simply hasn't taken care of himself habitually over the course of many years, such a person, yesh l'kol achad mehem derachim acherim v'hanhagos k'picholia k'mo she'isbayar b'sefer ha'refuz v'sh'neveses t'chilas choli. Those people should not engage in these activities. There are other things that they can do to keep themselves healthy, but in terms of the laudable practices that I've just prescribed, says Maimonides, says the Rambam, if you run the risk of harming yourself by engaging in them, then you are prohibited from doing so. Now, Jewish law, as many of us know, Jewish law classifies different activities and prohibitions and commands into a variety of strata. The most exalted, or perhaps the most explicit of which, or explicitly sourced of which, is called Daraisa, right? Torah laws, halachos minat Torah. And of course, the second, these of course are the two best known components of halacha. The second strata, the second tier, is derabanan, laws that apply because the rabbis instituted them. The Rambam has a very curious schema for delineating the differences between these two and the gradations within these categories, but those are the top two. Then below that seems to be this sort of nebulous category that the Rambam is invoking here, which is minhag. Minhag can range from something that is absolutely binding, even in the face of all contravening evidence. So, for instance, we have the principle in Chazal, minhag avaseinu biyadeinu. Because we've practiced something for a long time, even if its basis is completely eroded, there may be a reason to keep doing it anyway. So here, how has the Rambam classified the obligation to promote one's health? Which one of the three strata is he embraced here? Minhag. He says, "Chol minhagos atovim ha'elu." This is a minhag. I mean, it's a minhag to promote one's health. So seemingly, if a person is engaged in an activity that may pose a danger to oneself, but that may also promote one's health, like exercise, for instance, engage in playing basketball, playing baseball, maybe playing football, but one runs the risk of harming oneself, the obligation to refrain from such an activity exists only on the level of minhag, according to this source in the Rambam. Now take a look at source number two. Source number two tells us, Harbei devarim asru chachamim mipnei sheyesh bahem sakanas nefashos. There are myriad activities that Chazal prohibited on the basis of their potential threat to human beings. Sakanas nefashos. And moreover, says the Rambam, v'chala over aleihem, v'amar hareini masakin ba'atzmi, yuma'acherim alai b'kach, o eini makbid al kach. If a person says, listen, I'm not harming anybody else, I just don't care if I get hurt. If a person wants to harm me, I give him permission. Rishus biyado. He's perfectly allowed to do so. If a person wants to say that, not only is he prohibited from doing so, but, says the Rambam, makanas lo makas mardas. He gets lashes for rebelling. Now, makas mardas is a technical punishment. Because of Mishnah here has a whole discussion of what this entails. But makas mardas is generally administered for a violation of what? The Raisa or Derabanan? Right, maybe not even derabanan, but it's at least in the Rambam scheme, makas mardas is administered for those who violate principles that have no shemetz min haTorah, things that are purely on a rabbinic level. And here, if you'll notice, I bolded the words. The Rambam refers to the obligation to promote one's health as something that, or rather, the prohibition against harming oneself as something that asru chachamim, that the rabbis prohibited by decree. Now, is this in tension with our first source? What did the first source say? What did the first source say was the root of the obligation to promote one's health? It's a minhag. So here, the Rambam seems to be upping the seriousness of the matter here. So how does one resolve this Rambam with the previous Rambam? Make it worse. Look at source number 3. V'chein kol michshol sheyesh bo sakanas nefashos. Mitzvah, so any time that one encounters a stumbling block, a reason to fear for one's life, mitzvahs asay lahasiro ulehishamer mimenu ulehizar b'davar yafa yafa. There is a positive commandment for a person to remove that stumbling block, that potential threat to one's health, and to be very careful to preserve one's life. How do we know? Shene'emar, Hishamar lecha, Ushmor nafshecha ma'od. One must be careful to preserve one's life. The pasuk continues, Laman, losishchach, so that you shouldn't forget any of the laws of the Torah. And moreover, V'im lo hisir, V'himniach ha'mechsholos ha'mevin l'day sakana. If a person, as in the previous case, simply says, I don't care, listen, if there's a stumbling block in front of me, I'll take my chances. If there's a potentially dangerous situation that I'm about to encounter, I'm a brave person, I can do what I want. What if a person says that? Bitl mitzvah sasei, v'avra alav lo sasim dam. He has violated, or rather he has failed to uphold the positive commandment, and he has violated the prohibition expressed in the pasuk that says a person should not allow his life to be forfeit. So, what sort of law is the Rambam discussing here? Is it a minhag? I don't think so. Is it a daraisa or is it a derabanan? Sounds like it's a daraisa. He quotes a pasuk. Moreover, take a look at the next source, the Rashbates. The Rashbates tells us, in the same milieu as the Rambam, Le'inyan shmiras ha-nefesh, shayar v'perek shvuos ha-edus, amar shahamakalal es atzmo loke, with respect to promoting one's health and preserving one's life, there is a binding Torah obligation to do so on the basis of this very verse, which says that a person should preserve his life. And this follows the opinion of the Rabbi Avin. This follows the opinion of the Amora Rabbi Avin, the Amar, who says, Kol makom shene'emar, hishamer pen ve'al, eino elo lo saseh. Anytime you have a pasuk that expresses an idea and prefaces it with one of the words, Hishamer, pen, or al, those words indicate that we are dealing with a Torah prohibition. And he continues two lines later, Venira, he says, He says, not only is there one verse to support the idea that there is a prohibition upon endangering one's life, but there's an additional verse. A person must preserve their life very well. So the question becomes, given these three statements in the Rambam, how are we to classify the prohibition against endangering one's life and its corollary, preserving one's life? Is it a minhag? Is it a derabanan? Or is it a daraisa? Thoughts. How can we? It seems like a blatant three-way contradiction in the Rambam. So perhaps the Rambam has in mind different gradations of danger. That's the suggestion on the table. Now let's evaluate this. I think that's the right. We're on the right track. Now the question is, what does this mean? Can we draw any of this out from the context in the Rambam? In the first case of the Rambam, what sort of activities is he talking about? Is he talking about engaging in activities that are dangerous for the average person? No. What is he discussing? Let's rephrase the question. When the Rambam says a person shouldn't engage in certain practices because they are unhealthy, is the Rambam talking about healthy people or sick people? Very good. Azariah says sick people. He's saying that sick, normal people should engage in these activities, but only sick people should refrain from them. In other words, the Rambam here is talking about activities that, for a normal person, are helpful and promote a healthy lifestyle. However, for a certain subset of people, these practices would in fact promote the opposite end. And therefore, what the Rambam, it seems to me, what the Rambam seems to be discussing here is simply promoting a healthy lifestyle, knowing one's body and knowing how to take care of oneself in the aggregate. In other words, if a person wants to actively be healthy, to exercise, to eat right, sleep well, it is a minhag, it is a custom to engage in those things on a contingent basis. In other words, if a person knows that he needs 7 hours a night in order to be productive the next day, he should get 7 hours a night. If he knows he needs 8 hours, then he should get 8 hours. If he can suffice with 4 hours and still be productive, then 4 hours is fine as well. All of this is on the level of custom. What changes when we get to source number two? What element is added in there? It's two words. Sakanas nefashos. In source number two, we've arrived at a scenario where it seems that what we're dealing with is a situation that is dangerous to all people, regardless of prior health. In other words, we're dealing with a case where there may not be a clear and present danger, but there's a potential for even a normal, average person to be harmed by the activity in which he is engaged. And it is here that the Rambam says there is an Isser Derabanan, a rabbinic prohibition, to engage in these activities. There seems, however, to be some leeway. In other words, a person can't say, I don't care that I'm going to endanger myself, but there seems to be a bit of wiggle room. What constitutes sakanas nefashos? What if this person is exceptionally able to handle a situation of this sort? In other words, let's say you are a superior physical specimen, and running the New York City Marathon will present no problems for you. I can tell you that if I ran the New York City Marathon, I would be vomiting every 10 steps. I know myself. But let's say you have been running your entire life, you did track and field in high school. Running the New York City Marathon is not a ridiculous proposition. It likely doesn't rise to the level of sakanas nefashos, of self-endangerment. So it seems that the Rambam here is discussing a case where there is no clear and present danger, but there is certainly a degree of danger that applies to the average person. And it is this that the Rambam asserts is a rabbinical prohibition. What about source number three? In source number three, it seems that we are discussing michsholos hamavien lidei sakana, things, situations, obstacles that actively cause a person to be in danger. It's not just that the situation is one in which some people may find themselves uncomfortable. This is a situation where there seems to be a clear and present danger, an actual michshol, an actual obstacle, that threatens to trip a person up and cause him serious personal harm. In this case, the Rambam asserts that there is a scriptural prohibition, and the Rosh Beis asserts that there are two scriptural prohibitions, against engaging in this type of behavior. So now that we have this tripart schema, we can begin to attempt to map this on to playing sports. In other words, I think what we need to assert at the very outset is the following. There certainly is a spectrum when it comes to the sports world in terms of the level of danger involved. I would argue that, for instance, if a person is playing baseball, it's a very different proposition than if a person is playing football, which is a very different proposition than if a person is playing ice hockey or rugby or whatever the case may be. If a person wants to determine, at least from a first principles perspective, whether or not it is permissible to engage in these activities, a person presumably would have to assess the following, based on the Rambam's criteria. Is engaging in this activity healthy for me? That clears the minhag barrier. Is it dangerous for normal people, of which I am one? Is it dangerous for my class of individual? If not, then you've cleared the Dirabanan prohibition. And thirdly, is this something that is just actively and objectively dangerous, that represents a clear and present danger to human well-being? If you can demonstrate that it does not, then perhaps you've cleared the Dilraisa prohibition as well. Now, there are exceptions to this schematic presentation, and I'd like to explore two of them right now, two of them that appear, one that appears in the Gemara and one that appears in the later poskim. And then we'll conclude this portion of the talk. Look in source number five. Source number five is the Gemara in Shabbos that discusses the question of bloodletting, the ancient practice of bloodletting, which was considered to be exceedingly healthy and to promote a healthful lifestyle. Chazal, however, asserted that there were certain days upon which it was prohibited to receive bloodletting. And some of these explanations are rooted in the Persian cultural background of the Babylonian Talmud. So we have to ask ourselves, what did Chazal know and when did they know it? And this is, in fact, one of those cases. Chazal tells us the following. B'tchlasa b'shabsa, my time alone. On Tuesday, apparently, the Amora Shmuel asserted that it was prohibited to draw blood on those days. Why? Mishum dekaimala madim bezavi. Because Mars, it's an astrological principle, and Shmuel was an astrologer, Mars is aligned in such a fashion that it makes Tuesday a non-propitious day to draw blood. Okay, the ancient Persian scientific basis for this shouldn't occupy us now. The principle is very much the same. On a day when it would be unhealthy for whatever reason, of course, the principle applies regardless of whether or not we accept the astrological underpinnings. If there's ever a time when it is not propitious to draw blood or it is unhealthy, then there's a prohibition to do so. Even if, normally, this is a practice that promotes good health. The Gemara says, but Mali Shapsa Nami Kaima Bazavi. On Erev Shabbos, the same dangerous situation, the same dangerous context applies. So certainly on Erev Shabbos there should be a prohibition as well. Mars is aligned in the same way. And yet, the Gemara tells us that Shmuel himself would go and draw blood on Erev Shabbos. So what was his halachic basis for doing so? Says the Gemara, Kaven d'dashu be'rabim shomer psayim Hashem. Since so many people engage in this activity on a regular basis, the Pasuk in Tehillim tells us that God preserves and protects those who are wayward. In other words, people who do things that are not in their best interests, but since it's such a common activity, people often do these things, and since it's such a common activity, even if in an ideal sense we would wish that they would not do these things, because it's been built into the communal ethos to engage in these activities, HaKadosh Baruch Hu steps in and preserves people who are in this situation. So, what we have here, the principle of Shomer Psayim Hashem, seems to apply in a situation where it is exceedingly common to engage in these activities. In this case, if there is a threat to personal well-being, it is nonetheless permitted to engage in such an activity on the grounds that we believe that you will be protected nonetheless. So perhaps this might apply to sports that are commonly played all the time. Maybe baseball. Yes. Right. And so the question is, to what extent does God control those sources as well? In other words, if a person, I can understand, so the question would be, this might be a different case, because, and I think there's a point to this, and I think that it's worth pursuing this. In other words, is there a difference between saying it is permissible to endanger oneself when the endangering force is either supernatural, or perhaps in a more contemporary sense, extrinsic to the situation, or perhaps non-human, in that case, we readily concede that God will protect those who are wayward. However, if another person is actively attempting to endanger you, perhaps God gives license to that person, as he does in so many cases, to harm you. I think there is something to this. In fact, we might wish to distinguish in this case between sports like baseball and sports like football, like American football. Why? In baseball, let's say the object of the sport is to adhere to a specific set of rules, and a specific set of circumstances are created subsequent to this that dictate the outcome of the game. In other words, a person is supposed to hit the ball, and if he does and rounds the bases a certain number of times, or if he runs a certain distance, he scores a point. Whereas in football, the object of the game is not the object of the game, but a significant and perhaps integral byproduct of the game is to inflict harm on other people. So perhaps one might say that a sport where human intentional violence is an intrinsic part of it, or if not intrinsic, then at least then at least integral to the functioning of the sport, then perhaps it wouldn't be covered under the rubric of Shomer Psayim Hashem. Okay. Right, maybe, right, because they're really mashing into each other. Right, Dash Bei Rabim, because they're literally mashing each other. Right, okay. So Shomer Psayim Hashem. Now, there's another justification that I believe, which is in source number 6, which is commonly cited, but I think needs to be explored with much greater detail in the context of playing sports. And that is the following. Nodbi Yehuda of Prague writes in one of his tshuvos, the tshuva is a fascinating tshuva. The tshuva is responding to the question whether or not it is permissible for a Jew to go hunting for pleasure, to hunt animals for pleasure. The Nodbi Yehuda believes, in principle, that this is an activity that should be discouraged. And it's not in consonance. It's not in consonance with traditional Jewish values that place a premium on life, including animal life. But the Nodav Yehuda concludes that there are scenarios where it would be permissible to go hunting for other reasons, and one of them is as follows. He says, "V'av gam bazeh, in this case, with respect to hunting, mishahu ani v'osezo lemechiyaso, if a person is engaged in hunting because that's his profession, he's poor, and this is his way to pull himself up by his bootstraps, this is permissible to anyone." In other words, a person is allowed to engage in a dangerous activity. And the Nodav Yehuda defines hunting as a dangerous activity because of the danger of self-inflicted injury or being injured by a cornered and aggressive animal. So the Nodav Yehuda says that just as it's permissible for a person to take on a dangerous trade like seafaring or being a traveling merchant where you expose yourself to theft and robbery and swindling by people who know the local market better than you, it's similarly permissible to adopt the profession of hunting. Why? Because when you're a hunter, even though you may be endangering yourself, you need this in order to survive. Shekol mi shehu letzorech mechiyaso farnasaso ein breira. A person doesn't have a choice. In other words, if a person wants to pull himself out of poverty, we can't limit his choices such that he has three different choices for how to pull himself out of poverty. If a person is poor, we have to be so sensitive to their plight that we have to allow them certain avenues of permissible activity that wouldn't necessarily be open to others. In other words, if a person is poor, if a person needs to provide for his family, he needs the maximum array of options that are available in order to allow himself to provide for himself and his family and so on and so forth. The HaTorah Amra, they love who knows the Esnafsho. A person is supposed to care for himself. That's what the Torah says. Amr Razal, and the rabbis say, why on earth would a person engage in an activity that requires him to haul things up and down a ramp or to have himself be hanged? Certainly, the only reason the person is doing it is because he desperately and viscerally wants to provide for his family. So certainly this must be permissible. This is traditionally identified as the Parnassa exception for engaging in dangerous activity. In other words, if a person wants to make a living, if a person needs to make a living, this is permissible for him. I think that by and large, our community, which is relatively well off and also relatively unathletic, often ignores the extent to which this argument should be seen as applying pervasively to playing sports. There are so many players of, let's say, college sports nowadays who are uncompensated. Now, there's a big debate, at least in American sports, and I presume in other countries as well, over whether or not collegiate athletes should be compensated for their activities. The arguments on both sides are compelling, and they don't need to occupy our time here. However, one component of the debate that is applicable to us is the following. Take American college football, for example. The predominant demographic from which college football draws its participants is low-income families from low-income neighborhoods who have no prospects other than playing athletics. These are people who, in many circumstances, are being saved by athletics from gangs, from drugs, and from other unsavory activities. And often, when you speak to professional athletes who have subsequently become successful, And when you ask them to reflect upon the life choices that led them to this point, you can sense a palpable sense of relief that sports has allowed them the opportunity to raise themselves, their parents, their children, and oftentimes their friends and associates out of a life that otherwise might have resulted in their death and in the deaths of innocent people. So I think when we assess the Parnassa exception, it becomes crucial for us to take into account that oftentimes the demographic that is playing athletics, by and large, professional athletics, require sports as an avenue of earning a Parnassa. Now, one might argue that once a person has made $35 million, then the Parnassa exception should no longer apply. I'm not necessarily convinced that this is the case. One could certainly make the argument that this is true. However, studies have shown that professional athletes are likely to spend money at a significantly faster rate than other people, primarily because many of these young men and women who come into such money are unused to having the luxury of this money, and oftentimes they're pressured by friends and associates or parents who have been estranged, who now somehow magically come back into their lives. They're asked for money, and often they feel guilted into doing so, because why should I be the only privileged person to come out of my situation intact? So I think very often it is imperative upon us as sensitive people with hopefully insight into the human condition to take into account how important it is to maximize the Parnassa exception. So this might be one other way of thinking about the permissibility of playing sports. Again, with bearing in mind that there is a spectrum from, let's say, baseball or curling to something a little bit more aggressive. Yes. How would this apply to Jews? It might not. But again, the Parnassa exception, I'm trying to deal here. That's a good point. How does this apply to Jews? Most Jews aren't in this situation. Perhaps not. In other words, if you're playing, the question would depend on the circumstances. Take a person like Tamir Goodman. Of course, an exceptional person. But a person like Tamir Goodman, is it permissible to play in the NBA or to play college basketball, where the risk of tearing an ACL or an MCL is far higher, statistically speaking, not only than in the normal population, but than in any other sport? Is it permissible for him to play this on the grounds that this is his Parnassa? The question is, do you need to be an Ani first in order for that to be true, or do we simply say that no? If you're a merchant, presumably you're making a decent salary. So if you're a socher hayam, if you're a person who travels from place to place selling merchandise, presumably you've made enough money so that you don't have to be a merchant every single day. And nonetheless, the permission is granted. So we would say that it's permissible. So what I'd like to do now is transition from the question of whether or not it is permissible to play sports to the question of, is there a value? Is there a kiyum? Not just in playing sports, but in following sports. And here I'd like to delineate several different arguments and the counter-objections to them. Following sports and engaging in playing sports is often justified on, I would say, two grounds, in the popular conventional sense, on two grounds, each of which I think is weak, to say the least. And there are two other possible arguments for following sports that I believe are stronger, and we need to elaborate upon these. The first justification for following sports, playing sports and also following sports, but primarily playing, is exercise. In other words, it's considered to be a good thing to be engaged in athletics. Why? Because if you're playing basketball, if you're playing baseball, if you're running around all day, you're going to be building up your strength. You're going to be fulfilling the dictate of the Rambam, who tells us that we need to engage in all of these physically exerting activities that stimulate ourselves in order to preserve our bodies for the future learning of Torah later on. Okay. The problem with this is as follows. From a health perspective, if a person wants to stay in shape and if a person wants to maintain a healthy lifestyle, one is far better off engaging in individual calisthenics without the competitive framework, and to engage in aerobics rather than to play basketball. It's just a very inefficient delivery system for preserving one's health. So I can't imagine a justification for following sports and playing sports and investing intellectual and spiritual energy in an activity that's designed to achieve something that could be achieved so much easier simply by engaging by using a Stairmaster or a treadmill. The counter objection to this is, well, there is something to be gained by encouraging, in other words, we if we want to really encourage young people, and older people for that matter, to engage in regular exercise, the best way to do this is by putting it in a competitive framework, because that will encourage people to do better, because it'll pit one child against another. Which, of course, only begs the question of, is this competition healthy? If it's healthy, I think we need to justify it on grounds that are more substantial and more serious than it's just healthful. It's a good way to preserve one's heart rate. The second justification for playing sports that is normally propounded in the course of our communal discourse is Kirov. In other words, if a person wants to really be able to interact with non-observant Jews, or with Gentiles for that matter, if a person wants to be able to interact fruitfully and productively with non-observant Jews, if a Rebbe in grade 5 wants to be able to relate to his students, the best way to do so is by knowing the box score from last night. Knowing what happened in the Leafs game, knowing what happened in the Jays game. If you really want to be on top of your students and relate to them in a way that won't alienate them, the best way to do it is by following sports. This seems to me to be special pleading. How many people do we know who don't follow sports at all, who are perfectly socially adjusted and likable and friendly? I find it very difficult to believe that the time spent following box scores and watching television and watching baseball and watching basketball is worth the slight, basically imperceptible boost in likability that a teacher will get from knowing the score versus just being an affable person. I think this is also a very weak justification. Now, the next two justifications I believe are much more substantial, and these should occupy our time. Now, as some of you may have guessed by now, I consider myself a sports fan. My wife is a sports fan, and sports is a very important part of my life. So the following two justifications are not just justifications, but principled reasons, I believe, for affirmatively following sports and engaging in athletics, I believe need to be grappled with much more seriously, and concomitantly, I believe the objections to them need to be examined with the utmost seriousness and critical thinking. Number one, innocently passing the time. There is, I believe, a great benefit to setting aside time over the course of one's day for letting off steam. Oftentimes, working with the baseball game on and the radio in the background is just a healthy way of passing the time in an innocent fashion. Let's back it up one step. The counter objection to this is that it's all narishkeit. From a Jewish perspective, we need to constantly be striving for spiritual excellence. And any moment that we're not striving for spiritual excellence is time wasted. It's a principled, it's a simplistic, and I believe obviously appealing argument. We should always be trying to get better. Who doesn't want to get better? Could it be that a Kadosh Baruch Hu wants us to spend time sitting next to our radio listening to the baseball game? How could it be? We always need to be getting better. I believe this is hevel shebehevel. I believe this is folly. How much pure evil in our world results from inadequacy and bitterness masquerading as constant striving for grandiosity? A person who attempts to improve oneself perpetually, every single second, in many cases, is destined to become self-hating, bitter. One of the most powerful films that I've ever seen is called American History X. For those of you who haven't seen it, it's about a group of neo-Nazis, one of whom reforms himself and eventually has to escape his cohorts. It stars Ed Norton. One of the most striking scenes to me is this grotesque, evil, brutal young neo-Nazi who randomly kills homeless people and physically tortures minorities, who spent the entire movie talking about the high ideals of the Aryan race. We're so perfect, and we need to scrub the world of the impurities of racial filth and all of this other vile invective. And as the movie progresses, and as he constantly pontificates on the purity of the Aryan race and how we constantly need to be striving for a perfected American society, he spends his time vandalizing drugstores, stealing from minorities, and killing people and torturing people. There's so much, and you can walk into any yeshiva, from YCT to the Mir to Brisk, you can walk into any of these yeshivas, as many of us have, and you can see people who are sitting on their couch smoking a cigarette telling you that you're wasting your time battling. I think there is something very serious to be said for having a release valve. Now, having said that, this, I believe, is the lesser of the two justifications, because it does require a concession to human frailty. And ideally, we would have a justification for following sports and for engaging in athletics that bespeaks a higher calling for a human being. And I believe that the following is just that justification. Many of us, follow athletics as children, spend an entirely disproportionate amount of time focused on these activities. Memorize numbers. We know everybody's average from their rookie season. We know how many points someone scored per game last year. We know how many rebounds they had. We know how many tackles they had. And as a person matures and gets older, hopefully, one would hope, the degree of obsession with these statistics and with the minutiae of sports falls by the wayside. One would hope that the enthusiasm, while it never disappears, wanes somewhat. And the question becomes, and I believe sort of elementary and high school teacher that you always had, who always mocked how obsessed you were with sports, I believe that there is some truth to that. There can't be a morally serious religion that allows us to spend that much time on it. But what is left? After we've left some of the obsession behind, what is left for us? What's left for our sports fandom? I believe the answer is that what is left is an ability to admire people who have achieved an unbelievable, nearly incomprehensible degree of excellence in their field without any feeling of jealousy towards those people. Why do we love... And speaking again as a Yankee fan, why do I love Derek Jeter? Why do I love Tino Martinez, who retired? If you're a hockey fan, why do you worship your favorite hockey player? Football player, why do you worship your favorite football player? The reason is because a person of this caliber has spent years of his life repeating a set of activities over and over and over again, until they are able to repeat those very same activities. They are built into their muscle memory. Until they are able to repeat those activities on the largest stage possible, when everything is at stake, under pressure, demonstrating grace and incomparable ability. That is what we admire. How similar are those skills to what is required for a successful Ben Torah? Constant repetition of an activity, again and again and again, until we know it Baal Peh, until it's seared into our brains, until we can perform with grace under pressure. When a person comes up to you and asks you a question about a difficult Tosfos, or about Pshat in a Pasuk, you have the answer at your fingertips. It's this that we admire. And in particular, we admire it in a context where jealousy is not at stake. None of us are under any illusions that we could ever be a LeBron James, that we could ever be a Kevin Durant, that we could ever be any of these people. Instead, we have pure, unadulterated admiration for a skill set that is crucial to our own spiritual development. That's why we care about them, and that's why we follow them. Of course, it's important to dispense, as one gets older and as one matures, it is important to dispense with some of the minutiae and some of the obsessiveness, but ultimately, I think that it's these qualities that we admire and that we adore in our Gedolei Torah, and in ourselves, and in our colleagues, that we ideally should learn to ignore. And I feel very deeply that a dismissive attitude towards this view of sports is unhealthy, because it bespeaks just a general dismissiveness in general. How many times has a person encountered a person who's so dismissive of anything but what oneself is good at, that tends not just into a dismissiveness of sports or of music or whatever the case may be, but just ends up creating a basic cynicism in a person that's a highly unattractive quality and belongs nowhere in a base medrash and nowhere in a ben Torah. The argument that I would put forth to you is that we follow sports and we admire our sports heroes, not because we want to learn from them how to do our taxes, not because we want to learn from them how to give to charity, and not because we want to learn from them how to be kind to other people. We learn from them because, in a very deep and important sense, we want to learn from them how to become better Lomdei Torah, better Ovdei Hashem. And with that, and with some time left, perhaps, I will conclude, and if there are any questions, I'd be glad to take them. Thank you very much for coming, and thank you very much for... this is my last event at Torah in Motion, and I look forward to the rest of the program. Yes? Engaging in sports yourselves. Right. Engaging in sports yourselves. I think part of engaging in sports oneself will have to be subsumed under the innocent passing of the time. Because again, in a community such as ours, it's rare to see a person spending so much time on it that it's really that much to the detriment of their other pursuits. Unless a person is really, I mean, for instance, Right. In other words, I remember when I was in high school, I was on the MTA wrestling team. Took first place in the Wittenberg tournament, and I remember we had practice 3 nights a week. All the schools that we wrestled, I think we were better than them because we probably were smarter than them. But the schools that we wrestled had practice 6 nights a week. And not just practice, they also had weight room sessions 3 days a week. So we were at a significant, physical disadvantage. But also in terms of our ability to productively engage in other activities, extracurriculars, Talmud Torah, and so on and so forth, I don't see the conflict being that conspicuous. But it is a good point, meaning it's worthwhile considering that at a certain point you've passed the tipping point of rest and relaxation. And this is for those who were there at my first talk. You pass the tipping point of rest and relaxation, and you enter into the realm of having to justify something simply for its own sake, which when it comes to engaging in athletics may not be possible. Thank you very much, everybody.